Welcome to In the Green Room. I'm Kinga.
And I'm Chet.
And this is Martin with Ken joining us as well. And
hello, Ken.
A secret guest.
Graham! Ranky!
Welcome Graham. In the Green Room. You probably want to get
How
up on the mic
your last
a
name?
Little bit.
Too. Oh, you have to be right on
Graham
the mic.
Graham Rankin.
Isn't that what I said? Rankin?
Yeah, that's it. Good.
Rankin.
You got it. You got it.
I've known Graham a long time through my hikes, and we just have nice conversations, and I realize how intelligent he is, and he's a financial expert.
Well, one thing I love about In the Green Room is that we have such a wide variety of topics we talk about. We have some shows where we just talk about winemaking. We have some shows where we talk about comedy. And then we have some shows like today that are really educational where people are going to be able to learn a lot of really useful information, how to potentially make their lives better with financial information. Because we were talking at lunch today, a lot of people don't have a solid foundation or foundational understanding of the financial system and how they can start investing and
I would say that nobody has that when they leave high school and college nowadays.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nobody. Which is, unless you're specifically studying that.
Which is really bizarre. It should be like the first thing you're taught. So that way, I don't know, it's bizarre.
Well, I looked it up. I think only 24 states in the U.S. actually require some sort of financial course in high school.
And but Arizona's not one of them.
I don't remember that. But it's also not required. So in other words, you could leave high school with absolutely no, you know, financial acumen mm-hmm. whatsoever. And as we talked at lunch, lots of people leave university with very little financial acumen, and yet...
Well, I went to a business school and went out into the world, and I thought I understood it, but as soon as I started doing my own accounting, as soon as I started having to get loans, as soon as I started, I had no idea. I had to really dig into it. I had to ask people. I had to seek information because I had no clue.
Yes. And I really think that's, you know, true for most people. It certainly was true for me. Mm-hmm. I did an economics degree. You know, never touch anything about, you know, financial. What are you going to do when you get a job?
Right.
Investing. Mm-hmm. You know, how to buy a home. You don't get that kind of stuff.
See, that's my brother got a financial degree, and he had a house in college. Like,
yes.
Well, I think people need to know your background, that you came from poverty.
Okay.
You worked multiple jobs starting at 11.
Yes.
Can you kind of fill us in there?
And then so, your accent, was it South Carolina?
No. South Carolina. North Carolina.
Oh, yes. And it's good to talk about that, too, because nowadays I feel like there's this really bizarre, it's almost like this jealousy of people that are successful you see online and stuff where people mm-hmm. like, not celebrating hard workers and that kind of behavior. And it should be celebrated. Like, your work ethic was insane. You were telling us you started working at the age of 11. So somebody that has that kind of dedication and had that kind of drive, you deserve to have all the success that you've had. And that should be celebrated.
Well,
that is so
it.
True.
And there's just all these people that think, like, all these people that got rich just inherited their money. No, most people work their ass off for
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
It's rare that it's the other way around. So...
Agreed.
I agree. And so we should look up to you and say you're a hero.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit about that work ethic.
Well, I think I'm more, you know, kind of the normal kind of person. So, you know, I grew up in Australia, you know, very poor background, no financial knowledge in our house.
You had to pay all your own bills. You said you saw
well,
that
I was,
at 11.
My parents were divorced, and mm-hmm.
If you wanted something, you had to figure it out.
I had to pay for it.
Right.
And so I got a full-time summer job at the age of 11. I'm sure the labor laws are a little different here and probably different in Australia.
Well, I was delivering papers at 11,
yeah.
so
yes.
it's similar but
yes.
different.
Yes.
So, you know, you have to show up to work on time, and, mm-hmm. and I save the money. That was to go to university. I somehow had this idea that even though most people didn't go to university, I needed to go.
So that's, you just were driven.
I was kind of driven. And I surprise myself now when I look back, why would an 11-year-old know
wow.
that he was in a deep, dark hole and had to dig his way out?
Because you're really smart. And obviously a professor saw that and... gave you an opportunity in London.
Well,
correct?
Well, although
you're jumping ahead, King.
Oh, okay,
yeah, exactly.
You're giving spoilers in his own story.
Yeah. Let him get through high school.
That's actually a good point, because when I was finished at grade 10, mm-hmm. the teacher said, "You know, you ought to just quit, get a job." Mm-hmm. And I said, "There's no way I'm quitting. I'm going to finish high school at least." So I went through high school. I had jobs actually on the weekends. I actually worked in a hotel bar, lied about my age, saved the money.
You were a hustler.
I was a hustler.
And you were saving money at that young age. That's incredible.
Exactly.
And you weren't splurging it. You were saving it.
Oh, no. There was nothing to splurge it on. But, so I had all these jobs. By the time I, was about to go to university, I had enough for 1 year. I had accumulated enough. I wasn't going to get any support from my family. Mm-hmm. So, I had enough to do the first year, but I had to win a scholarship.
Win a scholarship. That's what I would say to my kids, and both of them ended up with scholarships. Because you're winning a prize.
Yes.
Okay.
And you're working hard for it. It's not given to you.
No. It depends on your grades, and not everybody gets them. So I was lucky enough. I did win one, and that made life a little bit easier, but I still worked every summer through university to pay my way through.
So you're working and going to school.
Working and going to school.
Amazing.
So, the gist of it is that, I didn't have any, I wasn't wealthy. I was actually pretty poor. Mm-hmm. And so, by the time I finished high school, I know nothing about finances other than I needed to make cash. I knew nothing from university. I did take a job in London. I was lucky enough to find a job there. There was an Australian professor who asked me if I'd come to London with him. So I did that.
Because he saw your intelligence.
Well, he saw potential, perhaps, and a young, hardworking guy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I went there for a couple of years. It was an eye-opener because I'd lived in a very small town in Australia, a beach resort. Actually, my school had the second worst graduation rate in the state.
So oh, my.
Wow.
You're kind of working against, basically going upstream here.
You upped the average.
I did a little bit, yes. Okay. And it was a big public exam. You had to do that. And I remember that 23 out of 150 passed the test.
Wow.
That meant if you didn't pass it, you were kind of, you got a job as a bricklayer or something like that. So probably all changed now. But anyway, I was kind of working. Worked in London for a couple of years. Came back to Australia because we had a little bit of sickness in the family. And then
was nice you came back.
I came back.
And who was sick?
It was my mother, actually. Oh. She was
you're a good guy, so you came back for your mom. That's sweet.
But again, I thought, okay, I got an undergraduate degree. How do I progress? So I actually came to America to do a PhD.
So wait, how did you decide America?
Well, I'd come through here visiting, and I knew an American professor from the London Business School, and he was a very prominent guy, so I visited him. And he convinced me that, if you want to do financial stuff, it's in America.
And really?
Why finance?
That's interesting.
Because actually the London Business School was, very prominent in finance. There was a very famous chap by the name of Dick Brealey. So I started taking some classes there, master's level classes.
Dick Brealey?
Dick Brealey, very famous guy. So began to kind of get interested in, these kind of things. I had thought about, working in the financial industry. I really didn't know much about it.
Is that why you were so intrigued by it?
I think so. But I really didn't know much. I mean, which reminds you that most young people really don't have much of a clue. Mm-hmm. Wanted to do. So that's how I ended up in London. A professor came and said, would you like to go to London? Well, I didn't know anything else. So London sounded like a pretty good place to go. And I learned some things there. So I was willing to take a bit of risk. Again, there wasn't much to lose. So I took the job in London, paid like a church mouse, honestly. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely... kind of very low-paid job. Mm-hmm. But, again, you're learning, and you're kind of investing in skills.
Right, right.
And so I came to America, did a PhD. I taught at the University of Arizona.
Your goal to be successful? Because I feel you live in the nicest area in Arizona, the nicest. and you have, you know, more than one residence, you're very successful. Was that your goal?
Well, actually, my goal was I was terrified of being wiped out.
Okay.
You know, not so much the upside, but I just didn't want to end up having absolutely nothing.
Right.
Okay.
Sort of kind of like some members of our family during the Depression, they were wiped out. So, you know, so this was, God, you know, it really could be bad if, you know, you lost a job and or you didn't have a job and you got sick, those kind of things. So it was terror, really, that drove me because I kind of lived my childhood like that. You know, where it was...
You were worried about the next
the
meal?
The next meal, what was life going to present? So that's why I had to, you know, kind of work hard.
Right.
So I had a work ethic, and it's been described these days by a very famous psychologist, Angela Duckworth, as grit. And she was a psychology professor who studied, you know, what was it that made some high school kids successful, despite the fact that they lived in poor circumstances and often weren't the smartest, you know, kind of kids. And so she did a PhD on this. And
this is very interesting. Okay, so let's really talk about this.
So what she found, and again, I'm not a psychologist, so if I do injustice to her work, I hope she doesn't sue me. But what she kind of,
I think you'll be okay.
He's a trial lawyer; he'll defend you.
Yeah, thank you. So essentially, she said that these young people that succeeded, despite all circumstances, in other words, they had grit. And by the way, if you look up Angela Duckworth, you can take the grit test. There's a grit index.
Really?
Yeah, you can find it online, 10 questions, and determine...
Like, what kind of questions?
Oh, I'd be hard-pressed to recall... You know,
you're going to have to. You're going to have to go and find out.
Yeah.
Can look it up to see if you have any grit
And take it. But what she found was that these are people who didn't think their growth was predetermined. In other words, you know, when they took a test, you know, some people, the non-growth mindset people, kind of said, you know, I don't know anything about that, and that's why I'm not doing very well on this. In other words, the growth people...
Meaning they give up.
They kind of give up because they think they're not smart or they don't have that particular skill. Mm-hmm. Whereas the growth mindset people basically had the view that they could change anything. Mm-hmm. They could learn it. Yeah. If you just put in enough time, you'll figure it out.
And you said these weren't necessarily the smartest.
No, they were...
The hardest working and with
kind
good
of
mindset.
The flip side of the really smart bored kid.
Yes.
In school.
Yes. But what they did say was, that's a challenge. And I can master this challenge.
You can do anything.
I can do anything with just enough effort.
Persistence.
And she calls it grit.
Right.
And my dad would grab every one of us and he'd say, you can do anything you want to do. You're the best. He'd say that to us like every day. And that's where I feel like I've passed that on to my kids because I always say that to them too.
Yes. And I think, you know, that if people come at that with this idea that it's not predetermined, I just put enough time in.
Right.
And now I think they refer to it as kind of anything, it's 10,000 hours. And
right.
I don't know who came up with that idea, but...
10,000 hours.
Oh, it's the guy with the curly hair.
Yes, Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes.
Outliers.
Yes,
that's
love
right.
that book.
Yes, Outliers. And basically, he studied successful people, and it turned out, I think in lots of cases, it was 10,000 hours is what you needed. And consistently, if you wanted to be a great pianist... You know,
you'd have 10,000 hours on the keyboard.
Exactly.
A music producer.
That's
yes.
right.
DJ. There you go.
Well, yeah,
10,
I mean,
hours, Jeff.
Well, some people are lucky enough to do something that they love. Like when I'm working on my music for 10 hours,
deep
12
chitty.
Hours in the studio.
Find deep chitty.
I enjoy that. Grit.
Right.
It's grit, but I love what I do. So I'm so lucky to be like working in a field that I love and I'm passionate about. But for people that, you know, don't love their job quite as much as I do, it really is gritting through it and, you know, getting those 8 hours, 10 hours out of the way, because I have a lot of friends
also,
that don't love their jobs.
It's also getting through that to knowing that there's something better beyond, right?
Yes.
Rather than just getting stuck there and just going, this is the best it's ever going to be, right?
Yes.
Because a lot of people do that too.
Well, that's why some people, if you really, really hate your job, you should look into trying to work in a field that might interests mm-hmm. you, even if you're going to take a little bit of a pay cut, like if you're working yes. in something yes. that you find interesting and is one satisfying of my, your soul.
One of my favorite quotes is if you love your work, you'll never work a day in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, I love, love that. That. And also, if you're...
If, even if you love your work, you still got to work your ass off if you want to be good at what you're doing. So yes.
It's so true.
It's a revolving door.
So, well, and it's got to be a field in which there's... growth potential.
Yes.
I mean, 10,000 hours being a dishwasher doesn't make you a better dishwasher.
No.
So I'm not saying the name of this couple, but there's a couple that I've been friends with for a long time. And I during my divorce, I spent a lot of time with them. But they'd say, quit working. Quit talking about the show. People you meet. I'm like, I love doing that. And so when I was with them having dinner or whatever, I wasn't allowed to talk to people about my show.
Well, you're passionate about it.
I am.
That's weird
exactly.
that they try to tell you not to do it at all.
I stopped hanging out with them because you know what? I'm like, I want to be myself.
Let's hope they're not watching.
Well, also the
you
husband.
Know who you
also
are.
The husband kind of hit on me too.
Yes.
So,
I really hope they're not watching.
Definitely.
They're in a big fight.
So. but
she
doesn't know about it.
But I think if you love your job, it's going to be a lot easier to show up. You know, 40 hours a week.
So speaking of loving your job, you have been at Thunderbird School of Management for the last 25 years.
Yes.
And you have seen a lot of students come and go, and we were talking at lunch, that they're missing some key elements of just financial literacy, personal financial literacy. And so can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, just like, you know, I didn't have this background, you know, in my undergraduate or, you know, other kinds of things. I, when I began teaching, I realized people don't have a lot of this kind of financial acumen that they need. So, you know, gradually would kind of tailor some of the things that I did to kind of highlight a couple of the, you know, what I think is, you know, kind of really important stuff. And if I could say there's, you know, there's many different ideas, but if there was a takeaway from, you know, what we're doing here today, it's there's really two key ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first is you've got to set aside money for the long term.
Every day, once a week.
Yeah, regularly. And
how often?
And well, again, a long
different
time.
Different for every person.
Different, you know, weekly, monthly. And maybe I'll just sort of mention a little example, a little story that I saw in the financial press when I was teaching at Rice University. And it was a story about a Jacob de Haven. He was a wealthy merchant. He'd lent George Washington $450,000 in 1777. And the story in the Houston Chronicle was about a court case. It had gone all the way to the Supreme Court. Apparently, George Washington never paid the loan back or with interest.
It's unbelievable.
And his family was suing the federal government. And so,
and that is slow.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So this is 215 years later. Anyway, so I
and there's still one appeal.
That's right. Oh my
so, goodness. So I began thinking, well, what would happen if Jacob de Haven had kind of got George Washington to agree to a 5% rate of interest per year?
Right.
That's what we'd call compound interest. So,
define compound interest for those of us that don't know.
Yeah, so the basic idea would be, you know, if George Washington said, look, I just need the loan for 1 year, so what would Jacob de Haven get or what would George Washington have to pay? Well, he'd have to pay back the original principal, the $450,000, plus he'd have to pay 5% of that, and 5% of $450,000 is about $22,500. So, in other words, add that to the $450,000. That's about $472,000. And then that'd be it. But if George Washington said, look, I need it for one more year, you know, lend it to me, refinance my loan one more year. So how much would he have to pay? Well, he'd have to pay the new bigger number, the $472,000. But interest on that. So 5% of that, you know, that's probably $23,000.
So interest on interest.
Interest
which
on
means
so
you
interest
have to on leave the money in.
You have to leave the money in. So at this point, we've got George Washington being only 2 years into this. And then, you know, that'd be, you know, I don't know, $473,000. Now, I said to myself, well, you know, what would happen if he did that for another 213 years? In other words, what is it that the family might be suing the federal government for? So you read to the end of the article, and it turns out it's $16 billion.
Okay.
Mm. Now, you know, I know it's 215 years, but the point of this is that if you have a long horizon and you leave your money in for a long period of time, it can really accumulate. Mm. Now, I know $450,000 is a lot of money, but so is $16 billion. And it grew over time because it was left in there.
Right.
So that's the first idea. Now, most people don't live for 215 years, but they do work for 30 years. And that's the key kind of thing we'll come back to. That if you put small amounts in now and do it regularly over a long period of time, 30 years.
In the stock market?
Well, I'll get to what we put it in. So just getting the kind of the one idea across, and that's the time. Time makes a huge difference. Now, that's what we call time value of money. Now, you're going to need that if ever you get a loan on a house, because that's you've got to get a mortgage, which is basically a house loan. And you're going to have to understand something about interest there as well. But let's go back to that example. So it turns out the rest of the story was that the family wasn't suing for $16 billion. They were actually suing for $100 billion.
Why?
Well, that's
greedy.
I said to myself, well, I wonder, what does that mean? The family is kind of going to argue to the Supreme Court that they needed interest at a higher rate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know that, you know, 5% got you to
$16 billion.
So what would it take to get you to $100 billion? And this is the part that surprised me and why I've kept using this little story in my class. It turns out that interest rate, you know, and I usually say to my students, well, what would you guess? Is it?
They guess a high number.
They guess, you know, some say 10, some say 8.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then some, of course, are pretty close. But so, you know, I say, well, would you be surprised if I tell you it's 5.89%? In other words, you know, a smidgen increase in interest rate blows you from 16, you know, to 100 billion.
But that's only with compounding interest,
right? That's with compounding
interest. So that's why it's so crucial for people that are investing to make sure that account is compounding interest.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, the question that my students would say was, well, where do you get that bigger rate of interest? And, of course, you know, they learn that if you want a bigger return, there's usually a bit more risk. And then I usually sort of talk about the stock market, you know. So in other words, where can you get better returns? And so the second key message is that I would say to young people, you know, when you're 25 and you're going to be working for, you know, 35 years, whatever, put your money in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Chet, Dominic, are you guys listening?
And we can talk about how we do this.
Can $5 make a difference?
$5, anything. Mm-hmm. As long as you do it regularly and you do it over.
And you leave it alone.
Dominic, can you give up a hamburger? You give up a hamburger?
It's giving up a hamburger, you know, maybe once a day, once a month, whatever, once a week.
Or maybe watch a movie at home. Don't take your girlfriend to the movies.
Exactly.
You're just trying to start fights today. You're like exposing one cheater, and now you're like, don't you take your girlfriend to the movies?
So a lot of people would, you know, would probably say, oh, but the stock market's so risky. Look what's happening today. You know, the market's down. And a lot of people lived through the, you know, the financial crisis. You know, 2008, stocks dropped dramatically. And that's a bit tragic because a lot of people got out of the stock market in 2008. They bailed out. And they never got back in.
Mm.
Now, so let's just go back to that. You know, how has the stock market been good over the long run horizon? And I would say it's been phenomenally good. And this is kind of one of those things that I picked up along the way. And I actually share a sheet with this information. So let me just tell you. The stock market can be pretty risky.
Mm-hmm.
So if you kind of... So some people have done a calculation. How have stocks done over the last 96 years? And it turns out the worst year was 1931. And as you can imagine, that's the depression. And it dropped in that year 43%. So that means, you know, literally half of your stock portfolio just evaporated. That would be pretty alarming to people.
Oh, yeah.
People were jumping out the window.
People were jumping in New York out of tall buildings. They'd lost everything. And, of course, what was the best year? Well, it was after the recession, so 1933. And that turned out to be about a 50.
That was the best year?
That was the best year.
Mm-hmm. And if they would have, those people would have held on to their stocks, yes, they would have been fine.
Because it went up 53%. Mm-hmm. So if you kind of think about that, that's a range of, you know, minus 43 to plus 53. That's, you know, 100%.
Wow.
So lots of people think, oh, my God, why would you want to invest in the stock market? Well, here's the bottom line. What has been the average return over those 96 years? It's been 12% per year.
Wow, that's a lot.
12% per year.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. And so, again, you know, you could hit a bad year, like
1931. We're learning so much. Okay, keep going.
But if you keep it in the long run, there'll be ups and downs,
right.
But you've been in there a long time. So if those people that bailed out in 2008 had just left it in for two, 3 years, it came roaring back.
Well, and COVID is a good example.
Yes.
Immediately after COVID became a phenomenon, the stock market took a drastic plunge. Now that's only 2.5 years ago.
Yes.
It's, 100%?
Above that. Yes.
It's recently taken a little bit of a nosedive, but it's
But after COVID, you know, that was March 2000, 2020, it really did plummet. But it basically sort of gradually came up.
Okay, so Graham, can you dumb it down for somebody like Dominic that and Chet that don't know anything about this? not me.
Cut back on those hamburgers, boy.
Can you explain? So if
this
we,
part of the broadcast is sponsored by Kinga's Financial Services.
What does an ordinary person do?
Yes. So let's say Dominic wants to invest that $10. Okay. How do you do it? What do you do?
Well, so, you know, you really don't need very much to do this. We were talking at lunch. You could get an online brokerage account, Robinhood. Mm-hmm. What was the one you mentioned?
Robinhood. There's Acorn. There's Stash. I personally use Stash. Yes. I have it take $10 a week out of my checking account, and I just invested in a variety of things. We talked about indexes, which is kind of an average of a bunch of different ones. I like to look at companies that have the highest employee satisfaction rate because I think that that's a indication of success, and it's again going from the long haul over the last probably 40 years, those companies have done far better than just the stock market average.
Like maybe Porsche.
They
Their
were
employees
not on the
seem
last,
really happy.
Yeah, that was not on the last.
I just bought the new electric car, and all those employees at Scottsdale Porsche are so wonderful, and they love the manager David. Anyway, okay, continue.
That's right.
So if you don't want to get in, you're picking stocks. So if you don't want to do that, and you want to keep it really simple, you essentially buy what's called an ETF, an exchange traded fund, and that fund, you buy a share in it. You know. And essentially, it buys the shares in a broad index. So, like, there are ETFs that invest in the S&P 500, which is a...
What is S&P 500? Define that.
It's an index of the 500 highest value stocks on the New York Stock Exchange. Actually, I don't think it's strictly...
S&P 500.
I think it's the 500 largest U.S. stocks.
Chet, did you know that before today?
Yeah. That's common knowledge,
Yes.
Okay. Are you investing in this stuff?
I have a general investment account with Acorns,
Okay, so.
There you go.
Okay.
That's good. It's like good to just get started, like Graham was saying. Like, even if it's $2 a week, $10 a week, $20 a week, just doing something continuously. Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit. Exactly. Okay. All that matters.
All right, I'm starting this week.
And that's it, really. This is not rocket science. As much as I'd like to charge a high fee, financial advisory, it's very simple.
It sounds fun.
You've got to figure out what can you afford to put away regularly, you know,
and
leave it. And we can get
almost
to that.
Like gambling. It's like it's entertainment money. You're just like,
well, let's not call it gambling. Let's call it investing.
Yeah. It's kind of the reverse of gambling.
Yeah, exactly. and you're putting it, into this index, so you're well diversified. You're not sort of saying, well, I think I'll. I like Tesla cars. I'll buy Tesla
stuff. Porsche.
Okay, Porsche.
Porsche. Porsche. Exactly. I prefer the Porsche.
So, Tesla can go up and down, but you've got 500 companies in there, and some may do well, some may do badly. But on average, what I just mentioned was the average has been over the last 96 years about 12% per year.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, tell us about diversity in terms of investment, not racial or anything.
Yeah. So diversity just means, one stock might be having a good year, so its stock is going up. Another stock might be going down. And so they offset each other. That's what diversification is.
Mm. So also might be risk tolerance, right? Some of the stocks may be high risk, some of them may be low risk, but as an average.
Yes, exactly. And so, what I would say is, when you're 25, 30 and you're young, you've got
a
long horizon. Mm-hmm. And so pretty much this is what I did.
At more growth.
Yes, you're looking
on a little more risk.
Taking on a little bit more risk because you've got a long horizon.
Graham, I have a great idea.
But it's good to evaluate the amount of risk you're willing to take on because you don't want to be one of those people jumping from a window the next crash. So you don't want to put all your eggs in that basket.
Nobody that believes in God would jump out of a window.
That's a point that I'm making. But, basically what I'm saying is that there is a risk with the stock market. So.
Yes.
You shouldn't try to overinvest and go beyond what your means are and try to over. If you invest too much in one stock and then it crashes, you're screwed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
But that's why he said the S&P 500.
Yes. Yeah. Well-diversified.
And
the other thing is, again, you're leaving it in for a long period of time. But let me just, kind of mention.
Well-diversified S&P 500 and leave it
and
in
there,
for a long
and
time.
And there are, many others.
But I have a question. Can we do, I don't know if we'll do it monthly or every other month, where you give us homework. We're all going to do a little investing. Dominic's going to do it. Chet's going to do it. I'm going to do it. Baby steps. And we'll teach everybody out there as we're coming back and revisiting what we're doing and how it's going. That'd be fun.
So we each get $1,000 of Monopoly money.
Yes.
We all make our decisions.
Yes. Ken will give us all $1,000 and you'll tell us how to do it and we'll all invest it and we'll figure it out. That's perfect.
So a couple points. Ken in the car mentioned, he said, when you get older,
yes,
you're probably not going to want to take on as much risk. So you're probably going to, when you're 25, you're going to put maybe the majority in the stock market, like this index fund. But when you get up, in your 50s, 60s, you're probably going to cut back a bit on the stock market, a bit more on, essentially bonds, less risk, kind of maybe government securities. And that's a way of essentially not, you don't want to get to be 65, ready to leave your job, finding that that was a dreadful year for the market,
right. And
you've got to get a job at McDonald's cooking hamburgers.
So my father-in-law did very well, but he believed in real estate.
Yes.
And he believed in investing in, he'd find properties that were distressed, a really good value.
Well, this kind of goes back to the conversation we were talking about at lunch of people that are entrepreneurs, of the split between investing in their own business and investing in other stuff like the stock market, diversifying outside of investing in their business.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the point we kind of came to is that most people in that beginning stages, at least, of building their business, have to reinvest almost all of their resources into the business in order to get it off the ground and successful.
Mm-hmm. And managing a property is a business as well. There's a lot of expenses. There's lots of costs there that you don't know until you know.
Oh, yeah, I was saying kind of just broadening the scope that, if there's somebody that's listening that's starting their own business that's not necessarily in real estate, it would still be applicable to them. If you're starting your yogurt shop, you're probably not going to have extra funds to be pouring into the stock market.
Good point. Good point.
Well, it's like when we started the show.
Yeah.
I mean, back almost 8 years ago.
But once that yogurt shop is turning a profit, then you should start investing.
But see, here's
the
thing, though. I think this is the important part, and this is what I didn't do, and I think that I should have done, is that even when I was investing all my money back into the company, I wouldn't have missed $10 a week. Yeah. And exactly. If I would have done that for the last 30 years, I would have been in a lot better place than I am now.
So that's where there is a little bit of a debate there. So, like, how much of your resources can you divert to saving and investing while you're in entrepreneurial
And I think Graham's point is it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's because you put a dollar in today, it's going to be worth far more 30 years from now than you could earn on that.
So it's something good to be mindful of as an entrepreneur. You should be trying to set some stuff aside for investment, but also be investing in your business at the time.
Absolutely.
So. And then you could end up at Porsche buying a sustainable, very green car that is all electric, and we're saving the planet.
One show at a time.
So that's where
we could catchphrase.
That's good. I like that. So I think, you know, it's something everybody can do. And I think one message is, honestly, the stock market is the only place that an ordinary person can get real wealth.
Mm-hmm. But we don't want to be extraordinary.
You know, if you're not starting a business and you're not...
Hold on. We want to be extraordinary, not ordinary.
That's why he's trying. We're educating
people of all type right now.
I'm just talking about somebody who has a regular 9-to-5 job, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
That you're not going to build wealth, you know, real wealth, just with your 9-to-5 job.
You've got to be thinking ahead.
And a savings account. You've got to be thinking, can I eke out 10, 20 bucks a month, whatever, and put in that into the market?
Eat at home more and then save that money.
Where do you get the 10? I mean, you know, we come to some...
No $500 bottles of wine.
we come to some basic things. Is how do you make sure you've got the 10? Well, you know, you got to have some sort of a personal budget. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to know.
That's the key.
You got to know where your money, how much money's coming in and how much is going out, and basically what are you spending it on?
Right.
And most people, when they do this, they say, wow, I'm spending an awful lot on those Starbucks coffees, $4.50.
Ridiculous, right?
You know, every day.
No more Starbucks.
And I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that you've got to know where it's going.
You have to be aware. I think that's the key, is being aware of what you're spending.
Exactly. Do you know, I had a Starbucks the other day, like 2 days ago, and somebody rang it differently, and it was $7.25. And I didn't even complain. I didn't say, no it's usually four something.
I think it should be illegal for you to get more than one shot of coffee.
Especially before the show.
It is in every state in Arizona.
So people could take away one tip. I asked you this at lunch. You said the most important thing is that they just get started investing and get started now. And then do it regularly.
Yeah, that's it.
We'd also
talked about there's some online resources.
Yeah.
And we talked about
to
two.
To learn about this.
Yes, we want to learn.
Which two are your favorite?
Well, so...
The show, in the green room. Green.
Okay, there's three.
Monthly with Graham.
But I'm only here once.
That's right.
And
once a month.
And you want much more regular things. So I actually did a little search on YouTube, and it's amazing how much stuff there is that's free stuff on YouTube. You know, if you say, what's a budget? How do I manage a budget? It's amazing. What's a 401k? We haven't talked about 401k.
Okay, I want to know what that is.
We haven't talked about a 401k.
Well, YouTube it.
No. Yeah.
Well, I kind of know what it is, but I kind of don't.
Well, there's specifically one channel you guys were mentioning being really
what's the channel?
High-quality information.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. So the other place, Martin and I were talking about this, we used it to get our kids up on calculus, and it's called the Khan Academy, K-H-A-N, the Khan Academy. And I was looking there, and it turns out they've gone way beyond calculus.
Oh, it's amazing.
There is stuff on, you know, time value of money, 401ks. There's a wealth of information. Now, that wasn't available, you know, when I was growing up.
That wasn't available 10 years ago.
Yeah, no, exactly.
George Washington never had that.
No,
he didn't have the
internet, but... But it's all free and it's all available. So there's really, you know, there's no need to feel intimidated. You know, you're in your privacy of your living room where you're asking a question. You know, maybe you think it's a dumb question, what's a 401k? But just look through various, videos. Mm-hmm. You'll learn a ton of stuff there.
Well, we've had several billionaires on the show that I'm friends with. And I think the common denominator that I find in all of them that are so successful is that they don't put all the eggs in one basket.
Yes.
Like what you're saying.
Yes.
Absolutely. They all invest in the stock market, like what you're saying. and they have a mindset, I can do anything.
Yes.
And they all started from nothing.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I think. And that is the idea of, like, you know, so many people are vapor locked by fear. And it stops them from doing so many things. And
yes. To
have this idea, or just have, we've talked about it on the show before, of just
having
a larger faith that everything's going to work out.
Positive mentality.
Positive mentality, having that, you know.
Mindset.
There's a silver lining, right?
Yes.
And
that is so important to success.
Yes.
And just happiness in general.
Yes.
And
you're already successful if you're happy.
Absolutely. If you have enough, then you're successful, right?
Yes, exactly.
I love it. I love it. So, Graham, you came from this poverty. You have this huge success now. You're helping others. You're helping save the planet one show at a time.
Yes. Yep.
What is on your bucket list?
Oh, yeah. What are your financial hopes and dreams and bucket lists, fun things to do?
Well, you know, I think of kind of the money as an enabler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't...
Oh, I think of myself as one, but go
your
ahead.
Wife. Yeah. Oh, wait, say what your wife would say.
So I don't...
I'm an encourager.
On that note, his wife that passed away 5 years ago had something she'd say about money.
Money can solve this.
Yes.
Whenever they had a problem, she'd say money can solve
this. But it was the enabling part. It wasn't the goal isn't to just accumulate all the money.
That's right.
But it can solve a lot of problems.
Yes. That's right. And I'd say that, you know, I don't spend every day, every hour of my waking hour thinking, how do I make more money?
Good for you.
My friend Jerry does.
Yes. Yeah, and that's a sickness. Some people are really greedy.
No, he gives back. But he helps so many people. He's adopted 15
but still,
children.
If you let anything go unchecked, you can get addicted to anything. You can get addicted to Oreos. You can get addicted to alcohol. You can get addicted to making money. It's a mindset thing.
But all he does is help others, so yeah, that's all he does.
But if it's all you can focus on, I'm just saying, it can still be having positive effects on your
life.
Like
Ken,
but still your mindset could still be wrong about something.
One of the things I love about Ken and his wife, they always look for people to help. And his wife was always, there were different girls
she liked
and
to
kids
be a mentor.
That didn't have their way through college. And she'd say, oh, I want to help her. I want to help this person. I want to help that person. And they did. And they, you know, put them up in an apartment, give them the money to go to college. They helped a lot of people. And that's really how I like to be.
Yes.
I like to help others.
And I had some friends that, well, still do, and have they're Hasidic Jew. And they are very money motivated. And they said that after they got married, that money is like their sex. When they make money, that's their sex. I know, right? Like rolling around in a bed of money.
but cringy,
right? But it's just everybody's different,
yeah.
Right? But I want to go back to your enabling kind.
Yes.
So you know, so I think of it as it enables you to. You know, have a little, you know, spend it on the things that you think are important. Now, I'm a big believer in travel, and I was very lucky in my job at Thunderbird that I got to do many executive education programs all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Such as where? Name a few of them.
Well, I've done lots in Saudi Arabia, Libya, you know.
So they pay for you to go there?
Yes, and I, you know, teach a program, but I always... kind of went a little early, a couple of weeks early, or stayed a couple of weeks later.
But name a dozen places that you traveled to where you taught a program.
Honestly,
a dozen? Really?
Yeah.
I can't name what I had for breakfast.
Okay, just name a few. Your favorites.
You know, Czech Republic, Serbia, Bosnia. But let me get
so
to
safe places.
Yeah, yeah. But let me get to the. So I was running these programs in the Czech Republic, you know, basically from about, I don't know, 2006. And I would bring my family with me. And not, you know, my wife and daughter and my son would come. Now, you know, my son came every year. And he once came to me and said, Dad, you know, when we're traveling these different countries, we ought to see if we can climb the highest peak in every country we visit. So I said, that's a great goal.
Oh, I love that.
So I said, why don't you, you know, do the research? You know, I'll obviously pay the car that we're going to rent. But you're going to need to, you know, figure out the logistics, you know, how do we get to the place, you know, where are we going to get a map? This is, you know,
pre-Google.
Do we hire somebody to help us?
No, we weren't going to
do
that.
Your own.
All completely on our own. Okay. There's the two of us. And so, so we have literally hiked every peak in the Balkans.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And so I think the first one we did was Croatia. So I said, okay, I'll book the flights.
I've heard that's the prettiest place in the world.
It's fabulous. But the
wine too.
Pardon?
They have good
excellent
wine.
Those
are beautiful people.
It's
beautiful
great
people.
Beaches. It's mm-hmm. and lovely people.
Exactly. I hear the prettiest women live there, supposedly.
I don't know.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
My wife might see this, so. But so that's literally what we did. You know, I'd say we've got 3 weeks. Let's go do that.
Yeah.
And so we'd travel all around. So
where do you want to travel now?
Well, actually, in 2 weeks.
Oh yes, tell the story.
Oh,
this is amazing.
In 2 weeks.
It's amazing what he's saying.
Well. So I decided I kind of wanted to do one of these long-distance hikes.
Okay.
Now, you've probably heard people do the very famous Camino Santiago.
Oh,
yes.
Big
time.
The Way of St. James.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a 500-mile trek, through the Pyrenees, from French Pyrenees into Spain to Compostela, which is reputedly where St. James's bones are buried. So many people do this,
mm-hmm.
and I actually had some Australian friends do this. And, you know, I asked them, I said, so what did you get out of this experience? You know, I'll get to my experience in a moment. But and they said, well, we got a couple of things. The first thing that we got, and you meet many people on the trail. I think they did it in August. You know, so
we met on a trail, so I know you meet people on
that's
the trail.
Right. Many people do this, and they said the first thing is everybody has some interesting reason to be doing this walk.
Mm-hmm.
Some they said, it might have been a death in the family. They're recovering from an illness.
So 500 miles of just you're camping?
No.
You go to a hotel.
No, you go to these pensions because these are the pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. This is from the. Mm-hmm. You know, for 1,500 years,
people
have been
doing this. Yes.
So there are places, dormitories, where you can sleep and get a communal meal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you meet people and do that sort of stuff. So they said, first of all, it's really interesting hearing why people are doing it. Mm-hmm. And they're all varied. I mean, some are religious, mm-hmm. you know, spiritual,
everybody's
that kind of
stuff.
Or death
story.
Or whatever. It's kind of like Burning Man, it sounds like.
Everybody's got their own story.
Everybody's, and it's interesting to hear, you know.
It sounds like Burning Man.
Not really.
Okay.
Sounds like as much walking.
Okay, so we have 3 minutes. Okay.
Yeah. So, and I guess I'll jump to the last point, which connects to our talk, and that is, it might sound like 500 miles, but what it really is about is putting one foot after the other and doing it a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
That's very similar to the idea of compound interest.
Wow, I love that.
You know, each step doesn't seem very big, but you do a lot of them and you get to
I love
to
it.
Don't go backward.
That's right. And you end up in Compostela. So I'm going to do much shorter than that. I'm going to do Hadrian's Wall Walk.
Okay. Which,
tell us about that.
Which is a wall that the Emperor Hadrian built in 122 AD.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only 85 miles.
Only?
That's still a hike.
In Northern England, right on the Scottish mm-hmm. border.
And how many days will you be walking?
Oh, I'm
going to
be doing it
miles.
In 6 days. But the Emperor Hadrian built this wall to essentially keep the Scots kind of north.
Is that 20 miles a day?
About 14. Mm-hmm. About 14 miles.
So we only have a few minutes left, and we touched on, we've been so busy talking and having fun, we touched on the number one biggest tip we would want people to come away with, and that's get started now and stick with it. So what would the number two and three tips be behind that? Like
okay.
In closing,
with the stock
two
market.
Last bits of information.
Well, I guess the second part is being a bit of research on the idea of, you know, when do people retire, and the experts basically say that the majority of people, or let's say the median age, median, people are retiring at 62,
mm-hmm.
and they that's way too early, given you know what they've saved, and the average kind of person in the age group 55 to 64, so they're just about to retire, they've got $46,000. That's all they've got. That's now. What we've been saying is you can have a lot more than $46,000 if you put the money, you know.
Start early.
And start early, et cetera.
And invest it in stock market
exactly.
at the 401k.
Exactly. And so they don't have much to retire with, and their earnings are $63,000 pre-tax right before they retire. So in other words, and if you're retiring at 62, which is early, that's the minimum you can get a Social Security check. A lot of people think Social Security is going to be terrific, but it's very small. It's hardly livable,
Of investing, or excuse me, instead of retiring at 62, it's like enjoy life more until then by doing the investing in the stock market and making and the creating this money.
Yes.
Stick with it.
Exactly.
And make every day count. I mean, there are things that are totally free that are enjoyable, like our hikes.
Yes.
Like the sunsets, like the sunrise. I mean, there are things that you can take your girlfriend to do that don't cost any money. And instead,
people need to start thinking of exercise as saving them money because it's preventative. You money in healthcare at doctor's offices. So people need to start considering exercise as saving
seconds.
Money. But the show is about wrapped up here. Graham,
so
thank you so much.
Yes,
it was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Graham will be on soon. Saving the planet.
One show at a time.